Hi, I'm Jane Lindholm. I'm the host of Vermont Edition, and I just wanted to let you know that this podcast has been edited for brevity. Thanks for listening.
This is Vermont Edition. I'm Rick Singarian for Jane Lindholm. In the last few weeks, suicides by some well-known public figures have shocked a lot of people. News that fashion designer Kate Spade and chef Anthony Bourdain died by suicide surprised many and led to public discussion and soul-searching. A few weeks before that, I myself was shaken by the suicide of Frightened Rabbit lead singer Scott Hutchison. Those are all tragic losses. But new data from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention are even more concerning. Suicide rates are up 25% across the country from 1999 to 2016. That's nearly 45,000 Americans aged 10 or older who died by their own hand in 2016. And Vermonters are dying by suicide at a rate more than 35% higher than the national average. These are friends and neighbors, people we know, work with, meet in our daily lives, not just celebrities. So today, we're going to dig deeper into the data. We're going to try to understand why more people are deciding to take their own lives. And we'll discuss what we can do to prevent suicide. Joining us for the discussion today are Allison Kropf, a senior policy advisor at the Vermont Department of Mental Health and a former crisis clinician, Joellen Turalo, director of the Vermont Suicide Prevention Center, and Thomas Delaney, an assistant professor in the pediatrics department at UVM's Larner College of Medicine, who studies suicide prevention. Welcome to all three of you.
Welcome.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Tom, I touched briefly on the CDC suicide data. But what stands out to you from what they've reported?
Right. So Vermont has a differentially greater increase in suicide death rates than the nation as a whole. And you kind of made that point. And one of the things that we like to point out is just we try to use the numbers to tell the story about how serious and how great that increase is. So when I go back to my data and look at 2005, we look at death rates, which are rates per 100,000 persons. So in 2005, nationally, it was 11 people per 100,000 who died by suicide, and Vermont was 12.6. So we're about a person and a half worse rate. Flash forward to 2016, which is the latest year that we have data for, the national rates, as you said, have increased about 25%. So it's now 13.9 people per 100,000 who die by suicide. Vermont's 18.9. And that's where you get the figure of us being, you know, more than 30% greater increase. So it's not just that we're consistently higher than the national rate, it's that our rate of increase in suicide death is actually differentially worse. It's rising faster.
And Tom, I know we use these suicide deaths per 100,000 people as a number for a point of comparison, but in real numbers, about how many people died by suicide in Vermont in 2016?
It was about 118 people.
Yeah. So Allison, do these numbers have you concerned?
Absolutely. I think we know nationally this has been a problem. We see it increasing as a problem. But to see Vermont go up to a disparate degree compared to the nation is certainly concerning.
And Joellen, what do these data tell you?
Well, I come at this whole problem as a nationally and state licensed health educator. So what it tells me at large is that our overall understanding and ability to self-care and care for others in terms of whole health is in jeopardy, and we need to really focus on, you know, the balance between physical, mental, emotional, social, environmental, and spiritual health in fostering the whole health of a person. And we've worked very hard in Vermont over the last few years in developing parity between mental health and physical health. And recognizing when we're hurting physically is something that we're more accustomed to doing. Recognizing when we're hurting mentally and in terms of our social, emotional health is something that we're still learning to do.
Listeners, the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline number, it's always available 24 hours a day. That number is 1-800-273-8255. That's 1-800-273-8255, and that's also TALK. Allison, are there specific age groups that are more prone to take their own lives?
Yes. And I think Tom will speak very well to that data more specifically, but we've certainly highlighted we're losing more males, white males, in the age group of, is it 50 to 65, Tom?
Yes.
That's been really highlighted in this report. We also have some disparate groups with ethnicity and sexual orientation or LGBTQ community is at heightened risk, as well as the elderly population.
Tom, why don't you tell us more about that data?
Yeah, so there's a couple different ways we can look at the age data. One way is, again, comparing Vermont's leading causes of death versus the national leading causes of death, and this is from CDC. And what we see is for 2016, Vermont's age categories, so 25 to 34, 35 to 44, and so on, Vermont's death rates for suicide increased in almost every age category with the exception of ages 10 to 14. And that's noticeable because there's actually very, very few suicide deaths in that age range. So what we're seeing is that we may get some age ranges where we have more of an increase, but overall, all age ranges are increasing. In terms of the actual numbers of deaths, we do see the highest death rates are in ages 45 and above. And then when we break it out, specifically in the older population, our highest actual death rates is between age 70 and 74, which is probably older than a lot of people would expect. And certainly there's a lot of factors that probably play into that.
Well, Joellen, can you talk about some of the common factors for those who die by suicide?
Certainly. So raising awareness about risk factors and warning signs is probably one of the biggest things that we can do to fight suicide. When we do training with community members, and those are neighbors, friends, family members, and professionals, and that ranges from law enforcement to first responders, social workers, faith leaders, funeral directors are often involved with families who then are at higher risk because they've suffered the loss of a suicide. We really want people to be aware of the risk factors and warning signs, what to say and do, and how to get help. And that's called becoming a gatekeeper for suicide, being able to recognize them. So there are proven risk factors that, when present in a person's life, may increase his or her chance of suicidal thoughts or behaviors. Some of those known risk factors can cut across all stages of life, and others are more prevalent at certain stages. For example, an increase in substance abuse or neglect of personal appearance may look the same no matter the age of the person presenting it. So some signals of depression or hopelessness, prolonged sadness, can look similar across the lifespan. We also have to remember that any risk factors that are adverse to one's life that provide significant challenges, and that includes any kind of trauma, whether it's within the family, outside of the family. Recently, the Public Health Association had a meeting focused on climate change and its impact adversely on mental health. So any adverse childhood experiences in particular, when children are needing to learn the skills to be resilient and to feel like they have control in their life, can really impact mental health.
Let's take a call from Tony, who's calling from Shelburne, has a question about the data. Tony, thanks for calling Vermont Edition.
Hey, thanks for having me. Just a quick question. Does the suicide data include physician-assisted suicide? I know that's something now that's approved in Vermont. I was wondering if that goes into the data.
These numbers do not include the physician-assisted suicide.
And I don't know how many that is in total, but we'll try to find that over the last few years in Vermont since it has been approved by the legislature. Allison, how does mental illness and depression intersect with suicide?
I think one of the interesting things that has come out of this data is to find out that the majority of individuals who died by suicide over the time period they're looking at did not have a known mental health condition. And I do think that there is a misconception that it is a requirement to have chronic depression in order to have episodes of suicidal thoughts or suicidal actions. They certainly intersect. There are certain diagnoses where it's more prevalent to have suicidal thoughts. And we can identify risk factors for those who are in mental health care. But I do think what's been most interesting is for those who have died by suicide, they're more likely in the last 30 days to have seen their primary care physician than they have to have seen any mental health practitioner. So I just think that's important for us to know that it's non-discriminatory. You may not have any mental health history and end up having acute stress and crisis in your life that leads you to feeling hopeless and have some despair, and that could create inaction such as ending your life.
Now, we mentioned some of the data earlier about LGBTQ youth. Tom, can you kind of expand on that number?
Yeah. So one of the main things we look at to learn about the LGBTQ population, especially younger people, is the Youth Risk Behavior Survey. So Vermont has a really good rate of participation by schools, including public schools and independent schools in the YRBS. So based on that, we think we have a pretty good snapshot of where young people are thinking in terms of mental health risks and suicidal behavior. So specifically, when the Department of Health broke out LGBTQ youth versus non-LGBTQ youth, they found that the LGBTQ youth were about 3 times more likely to have felt sad or hopeless every day over 2 weeks during the past year, and that's a marker for major depressive disorder. They found that LGBTQ youth were 4 times more likely to have hurt themselves. So self-injury without necessarily having the intent of taking their lives, but this could be an example of cutting or piercing or something like that. LGBTQ youth were about 4 times more likely to have made a suicide plan in the past year. Obviously, that's a marker for somebody who's contemplating suicide and may move forward to actually making an attempt. And then when we actually look at attempts, LGBTQ youth were about 4.5 times more likely to have made a suicide attempt than non-LGBTQ youth.
Now, I think older white men are also a high-risk group in the data.
Yeah, absolutely. So one of the things that we like to do is we like to break out by age ranges and by gender at the same time to try and identify populations that might be at higher risk and who might benefit maybe from targeted programming or specific outreach. And indeed, the highest disparity we've seen for death rates in Vermont is 65 and above males. There's actually so few female deaths in that age range that you almost don't want to make the comparison, because if you look at over 65, it's almost entirely male deaths. That's in contrast with the U.S. So in the U.S., there's not as much of a disparity. There's still about a 3-to-1 ratio of male to female deaths. In Vermont, it's about 4-to-1 males to females.
Allison, do we know why men are so much more likely to die by suicide than women?
A lot of it has to do with the means by which they kill themselves. So the majority of men are using fatal means with guns. And so for females, the attempts are often higher at a higher rate, but they're using means that are less lethal, overdoses, attempts at suffocation, things like that. And men, maybe it has to do with more access to firearms. But regardless of that reason, there is the data that backs up that there is that high prevalence of just fatal means.
Yeah, if I could just jump in on that. So nationally, about 50 or 51% of all the people who died by suicide in 2016 had used a firearm. And in Vermont, we're just a hair under 60%. So again, Vermont's overrepresented for firearm deaths. That may tie in with the fact that we're overrepresented for males and maybe with rural white people as well.
Joel, and how much of an impact does means, you know, the access to pills, to firearms, have on someone's decision to take their own life?
It has tremendous influence, and so one of the major strategies that we try to work with family members as well as healthcare and mental health practitioners and providers is on counseling about lethal means at the time that somebody is at risk. During that crisis period, which can be very acute and intense for about 2 weeks, but can often last, you know, for up to two or three months, it's very important that the client or the person who is at risk be engaged in conversations collaboratively about making sure that they remain safe. And that's where a really comprehensive assessment, asking the right questions about how much they're thinking about suicide, to what extent, whether they have thought of a plan for suicide and if that plan included a means, and then really engaging in a collaborative safety planning process whereby that person identifies the means and everyone thinks collaboratively about how they can be removed during the period with which the person is at risk. And that is also a partnership with law enforcement, many communities. There is the ability to voluntarily say for this period of time, I'd like safe storage of my means, and they're removed from the household and returned when the person indicates.
Let's go back to the phones and take a caller from Stowe who wants to share a story. Hi, thanks for joining us on Vermont Edition today.
Yeah, hi. I recently had a self-inflicted death in my family. It was a post-retirement individual, been very successful in life, and ran into some not unsolvable financial problems, more liquidity versus net worth, but he asked me to work with him, and I did, and it never occurred to me that he would do that, and I just wish that I could have reached out to him on an emotional level rather than a functional level. He had other friends who he was also seeking help from. And so I think that what your show is all about is very apt, because I think this individual hit all the things you're talking about. So I'll just listen to your response.
If I could jump in here, thank you for sharing your story. And I'm very sorry, as all of us, for your loss and for the loss of the family and the community at large. These kinds of incidents and events take a huge toll emotionally, and they have a lot of impact on the emotional and social climate in the family, and then consequently on access to health services. It's very costly on many levels, both human capital, social capital, as well as healthcare costs. In midlife, you asked the question earlier about men and higher risk. Increased responsibilities, of course, are a part of midlife, and increased pressure, and there's a tremendous amount of social emphasis on personal responsibility, and debt or other financial trouble is often a very major risk factor for men in particular in midlife. As are other risk factors for men in that age group. In general, people in midlife are dealing with issues around employment. Significant health issues may start to emerge in life, chronic pain. That's the period of life when relationships that may have been long-term come to an end. So all of these kinds of activities that occur in midlife during what we call the generative stage of life can become very, very complex and overwhelming for people to cope with. And so the biggest thing we can do is become very sensitive to all the nuances that put people at risk across ages. And as I said earlier, some of those risks are different depending on the stage of life. And be willing to have the conversations, just bring it up, check in. Hey, I know this is tough for you. How are you doing with all of this? And can we talk about it?
We've been hearing from a lot of people sharing stories, and I'll just offer a couple that we heard from a couple of Redditors. Knej910 writes, I am a teenager from Vermont. I know two people who have committed suicide. I also know other teenagers in my area who have or who have had suicidal thoughts, including myself. I personally do not have suicidal thoughts anymore. I'm living a very happy life now, but I'm still affected by it, as I have found myself in many situations where I've had to help some of my peers out of self-harm or even out of suicide. One of the worst experiences I had was with my own ex-girlfriend. She was great at first, but became suicidal over time. I remember countless nights staying up past midnight, sometimes even until 4 a.m., calling her and talking to her, reassuring her. We broke up, but I still keep in touch with her. She acted almost as if her life depended on me. One night, she told me she was going to commit suicide. I still remember calling her parents immediately. They had her admitted to a hospital. She basically never spoke to me again after that. but what matters to me is that she is still alive today. And another, Pongpyeon Skull, writes, I've struggled with suicidal thoughts. I was put on a six-month waiting list to see a doctor by my primary care nurse. But I'm going to try to find one of my own before then. Isolation is a big problem for me. Tom, can we make any assumptions about the impact of the shortage of psychiatrists, psychiatric care, from the number of suicides and from the data?
I don't know if we can make assumptions about the data in terms of the deaths or even the attempts, but I think there's a pretty good consensus that there's an opportunity by working with primary care providers to maybe strengthen the safety net, maybe do a little more proactive identification of people who might be at risk, and maybe initiate referrals differently or have more co-located behavioral health providers. And these are all things that Vermont's doing to a greater or lesser degree. I'm particularly interested in sort of reforming and maybe redesigning certain aspects of the medical curriculum and the residency curriculum, because I think that there are opportunities to have primary care be playing a greater role, and not that they would become psychiatrists, but they might actually work in a more complementary way or more seamlessly with psychiatric services or behavioral health services.
Allison, can you address what the state is doing?
Yes, I can certainly agree that nationally it's an issue for a shortage of psychiatry, and that has also impacted Vermont. I think I completely agree with what Tom said. I would say that some of the things that we are doing is having psychiatry consult with primary care for cases so that they can handle them more immediately. We also have telemedicine because we know in some pockets of Vermont it's harder to gain access. So that's being explored more. But I think also this hits up on this idea that that suicidality is a mental health issue. It's very integrated. And so I do think it's going to be a concurrent approach. And I think that the more that primary care works with psychiatry, the less we might have to just depend on a subset of professionals who can address this issue.
Let's take a call from Beth, who is calling from Rutland. Hi, Beth. Thanks for calling Vermont Edition.
Hi, thank you. I'm a woman who's over 50, and when my girlfriends and I get together, we often end up talking about significant males in our lives. And what we talk about a lot about these guys is the fact that, I will give you a quick example. I have a male friend, and I'll say to him, oh, have you talked with John lately? And he'll say, oh, yeah. And I'll say, oh, is he going out with someone? Has he started living with someone yet? And he'll say, oh, my friend will say, oh, well, we don't talk about that. And it's like, what in hell do you talk about? And I think that's the biggest problem with men, like, over 45. They don't talk about what's important. So I will get off the air and listen. Thank you.
And I believe they also kind of let those friendships with other males drift away. Tom, is that the case?
I couldn't really tell you from any data. I mean, anecdotally, I think that certainly seems to be the case.
But is there something being done, like I think in Britain, where they have a program to get men to reconnect?
Yes, and this is a program that's near and dear to my heart. So in the fall of 2016, I did sort of a site visit to Britain to look at some of the suicide prevention activities that I wasn't so familiar with or didn't exist in the U.S. And one of the things that they've developed over there and in Australia is called Men's Sheds. You can probably find this on just Google, Men's Sheds. But it's a network of small nonprofit workshops, basically woodworking, metalworking, things like that. And the idea is that typically middle-aged and older, you don't have to be middle-aged, but more so that age range, get together with a volunteer coordinator at each of these little working shops, and they work on projects. They get together, they collaborate. I think it causes feelings of belonging, feelings of importance. You know, men are sort of socialized to be responsible and be providers, and these are working on projects where they have responsibility, and, you know, maybe they're unemployed, maybe they're socially isolated, but the men's shed give them an opportunity to sort of feel better about themselves. And I'll point out, it's not actually a mental health intervention, but when you actually go and learn about these programs, it's like, wow, This actually is promoting positive aspects of mental health and is probably protective for things like suicide attempts and maybe substance abuse. Who knows?
Now, today we have been mentioning the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline number, which is 1-800-273-TALK. That's 1-800-273-8255. Allison, what is the discussion like when someone calls a suicide prevention hotline?
Well, the suicide prevention hotline is it's connecting you to the nearest resource where someone's available 24/7. So I will say it will not always get you to your local crisis center. Those are different lines. But the idea is they're there to actively listen. And from there, those calls are triaged. So somebody who might need immediate, you know, if the first thing that they're going to look into is whether or not this is a 911 response. So that will be handled. But short of that, they're there actively listening. So for a lot of the population, sometimes that's all they need is someone who isn't too busy, who is, you know, there for the specific reason of hearing them out and validating their concerns. And sometimes it's easier to get from somebody who doesn't know you, right? So if you go to a friend or family member, they may want to cheer you up. And really what sometimes a lot of people need is not somebody to convince them that their feelings are wrong, but to really hear why they feel that way, validate why they feel that way. And then at the end, of course, the Lifeline has the resources to direct them to care. So sometimes they will hand that off directly. They'll make a call to a crisis, to the local crisis center. Other times they'll just provide them resources depending on the severity of the need.
Joellen, what kind of training do those taking calls get?
There is a training called the ASSIST training, which is applied suicide intervention skills training. And so anybody who is responding on the National Lifelines, as well as our Vermont 211, and many of those calls get triaged out. They have ASSIST training, which is an intensive 2-day training on identifying signs, learning how to have the conversation, being supportive, identifying level of risk, and then connecting somebody to resources and support. While we're talking about hotlines, we should also mention that there is the National Veterans Hotline specifically to respond to veterans in crisis or who need to just talk or have support and connect to their state or local regional resources. That number is 1-800-273-8255. And there's also a national hotline run out of the Trevor Project for GLBTQ. And you can Google that up or call directly to 866-488-7386.
Joellen, does a celebrity suicide impact call volume? And if so, why?
Well, certainly the suicides of two beloved figures who are both hugely successful people and were surrounded by family, friends, and a lot of distant admirers remind us how insidious mental health problems and depression can be. But nationally and statistically, when you follow the response to suicide, a lot has to do with the way the family itself handles with the media the reporting of the suicide. Families that acknowledge that the person had mental health problems over time and or that there may have been indicators of risk that were missed, that encourage people to talk about what is going on with them in terms of painful feelings, isolation, overwhelm. That has a direct impact on what we call contagion suicides. That results following a major event.
Tom, is increased public awareness of suicide a good thing? Does it inspire others to contemplate suicide, or does it break down some of the stigma of talking about it openly?
I think that the data that exists would suggest that responsible discussions of suicide are health promoting, and that, I think that Joellen alluded to this, but the idea that the way people are talking about suicide has a big impact on how people who may be vulnerable actually feel and how they act. So if the conversation is more about seeking resources, if it's about reducing stigma, if it's about connecting with primary care, connecting with mental health resources, finding other people who may have similar challenges, that seems like a positive and helpful conversation.
Allison, are there changes in behaviors that might inform that someone is contemplating suicide?
Yes. Certainly, any increase in isolated behavior, so people who normally might be going out with their friends who are all of a sudden turning down those opportunities. So changes in behavior in general, but changes towards isolation, certainly. Giving away belongings is certainly a very big red flag. If all of a sudden, especially for the elderly population who have sometimes coveted a lot of belongings in their lifetime, if they start giving those away, that's a sign to look out for. And I know we've worked on the gun shop project with some of our sportsmen and people who are out there in the gun shops to give them some indicators of who might be coming into their shop who are not seeking a weapon for the purpose of sportsmanship. And so a sudden interest in owning a gun without any knowledge of how to load one, without any indication of what they might be using it for, is certainly something for them to be looking out for.
Tom, I think Allison mentioned that about 60% of people who decide to commit suicide last saw their personal care physician. So are our personal care professionals being trained to spot the tendencies of suicide?
They absolutely are. But the question for me as an academic and as an instructor in a medical school is really how consistently is it being done and is it being emphasized in a way that would be most helpful for primary care physicians. So there's an awful lot that has to be crammed into the medical curriculum and also an awful lot that has to be crammed into the residency programs for primary care providers. So I think the challenge in that area is to really work with the curriculum and figure out how best to emphasize, how best to empower the physicians and physicians in training to spot the warning signs, initiate care, talk about lethal means safety. So one of the ways that we think primary care providers as suicide prevention advocates are really powerful is that they are actually seeing people much more often than mental health professionals, but they're often not prepared to actually have the conversation about lethal means safety and specifically around firearms because it's a politically charged topic, personally charged topic. So one of the ideas that we're exploring is how do you actually work with providers so they feel more comfortable having that. And a great thing about the Zero Suicide Pilot Initiative in Vermont is that it promotes a training called CALM, which is Counseling on Access to Lethal Means. And, if I had my way, everybody who's a healthcare provider or mental health care provider in the state would do the CALM training because it helps you develop the competency to actually talk to people about why and how they should keep their weapons safe.
Say that the CALM training is available online free, and it's being redesigned as we speak, and they will have a new rollout of an updated course, although the old one is very good. It's short, brief, free, and that will be in September.
I want to read a couple more of the comments we've gotten from listeners so far. Redditor Jackson Gray writes, in the early 2000s, my youngest brother attempted suicide by taking a bunch of our parents' pills. He realized the gravity of what he did and told mom. She called 911. Today, he's alive and fine, and his depression and anxiety are being treated by medication that has turned his world around for the better. A friend from high school lost her 14-year-old daughter to suicide earlier this year. She was bullied at school, and nobody at the school did anything about it despite it being reported repeatedly. Based on my own experiences at the same high school 20 years ago, it sounds like little has changed. Vermont is very bad about giving people options to get help. There is a dearth of resources for mental health, meaning everyone is overbooked, overcharging, or not a good fit. That leaves nobody else to go to. So you get stuck with rural areas having it the worst. Anne wrote, my brother committed suicide in 2016, age 49, leaving two young children who were the lives of his life. He was one of the most successful and joyful people I knew. He became depressed and was dead within 4 months. The stigma of depression was one of the factors that led to his suicide, a sense that everyone else was perfect and happy and successful apart from him. The myth of success and the stigma of depression must change. They're killers. And a reminder that we have resources on our website for you or a loved one who might be considering suicide. The National Suicide Prevention Lifeline number is always available 24 hours a day. That number again, 1-800-273-8255. Let's go to the calls again, and let's hear from John, who's joining us from Essex. John, thanks for calling today.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call, a long-time listener. And thank you for bringing this up. I'm 47 years old. I've got two young kids, and about 3 years ago, I attempted to take my life. It was a sincere attempt. But what I wanted to comment about was that, you know, for me, I think, like Anthony Bourdain and Kate Spade, you know, I got to a place where I just was going to do it, and I was ready to leave this earth. And, you know, I had lived 365 days before that without trying to, or even sincerely thinking about killing myself. I had pressures. I had all of the factors that ultimately led me to try to kill myself were on me every day. But something about that one day, you know, I just hit bottom. And what I needed was I needed to get through it. You know, in addiction, I'm a former addict. You know, we call it surfing the urge. And that's what I had to do. I didn't. I actually went all the way, but I just, at the last minute, I changed my mind, thankfully. And I never looked back. So one of the things I just, you're talking about prevention, and something I haven't really heard a lot of is, you know, not everyone, but for a lot of people, killing themselves is a momentary thing that, you know, it may be in their mind, in the back of their mind, but actually following through is often something that, you know, is associated with just that moment. And if you can, if you know someone who's depressed or who's bottoming, and you can just get them so they're not alone, you know, talk to them, you know, get them away from, like, their thoughts, and something will happen, in the next day, you know, anything that might give them a reason to live and hope. And like me, you know, they'll never look back and won't think about it again.
John, thank you so much for sharing that, and we're so glad to have you. Joe Ellen, let's talk first about someone who is considering suicide. What do you recommend they do?
The most important thing that somebody can do is to care for themselves enough to recognize that they are having major troubles and need help. Talking is probably the most therapeutic thing somebody can do, but people get stuck. And so if you're around somebody who is vulnerable or maybe in distress, having conversations about difficult feelings, challenges in life, pain, is one of the most important things we can do. Expressing ourselves to others when we're having difficult times, and sharing your concern about others when they're having difficult times. You may have heard of the You Matter message created by the Vermont Suicide Prevention Coalition. And the message is, you matter because you may need help. And you matter because you may be in a position to help. And at different times in life, we are going to be in both of those roles. And so offering support to ourselves through self-care, caring for ourselves physically, caring for ourselves socially and mentally, reaching out. Parents, family members, and friends often hesitate because they're afraid that asking about suicide might trigger it. But the research shows very clearly that the opposite is true. It actually makes people feel better understood and opens up the conversation to finding help. So silence, both when we're vulnerable and silence when we perceive somebody else is vulnerable, is actually part of the problem.
But Allison, that is a difficult conversation to start. How do we do it?
It is a difficult conversation to start. And when we do trainings, whether it be with the community, there's a great training out there called Mental Health First Aid. And it's for any community members as well as other professionals. And one of the things we do often in that training is to have people practice. How do you even ask that question? Let's pretend you're sitting down with somebody and role play it, because it can get stuck in your throat. And I think that it helps to know that it's not going, that there's no research and data to support that that's going to trigger the thought in somebody. And I think that's a huge misconception that people need to get past. And so understand that for that person who's feeling that pain, For you to ask that question shows that you care. You might be wildly off base. That's the worst case scenario, right? So what? And I think the best case scenario is you've just validated someone's feelings and you've helped them to see that someone else might actually know what they're thinking and how they're feeling.
Tom, is there proper nomenclature to use for this discussion when you're talking to someone about their suicidal thoughts?
Well, I'd probably defer to Allison for that, but I just wanted to make the point that John's point about that one day and vulnerable for a specific period of time is really important, and that's one reason that people's misuse of substances or increasingly use of substances or purchasing a firearm or even just having access to a firearm, suicide can be a sort of temporary, sort of impulsive thing against a background of prolonged distress. And if you can get the person through that temporary time, they're probably going to survive. And most people who attempt suicide actually go on to live a long life. Most people don't actually take their lives.
Interesting. The nomenclature question to you, Allison?
Yes, I would jump in on that by saying I think sometimes people dance around the actual language sometimes, and we would discourage against that. If you're going to try to ask if someone's thinking about suicide, try not to delicately say, have you ever any difficult thoughts or thoughts of, you know, and not just say the words. Say the words. Are you thinking about suicide? Have you ever thought about how you might kill yourself? Being direct and using plain language just takes, it just gets right to the point, and we really need to know the answer to that question.
Because being vague doesn't really address it. They don't know if you're really asking them about suicide.
Yes.
Wow.
And if you know somebody is at extreme risk, you can actually ask a question such as, would you tell me about your thoughts of suicide? And if they're not having any, they will tell you. And if they are, then hopefully that opens up the conversation for help.
I want to thank everyone who contributed their thoughts and experiences to this important discussion today about suicide and suicide prevention. Thanks to our guests, Allison Kronf, a senior policy advisor at the Vermont Department of Mental Health and a former crisis clinician, Joellen Turalo, director of the Vermont Suicide Prevention Center, and Thomas Delaney, an assistant professor in the pediatrics department at UVM's Lerner College of Medicine, who studies suicide prevention. Thanks to all three of you for sharing your expertise with us today.
You're welcome, and thank you for having us.